Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of some articles that I have written. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, you will discover there are some articles that I produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. We continue our exposition of 2 Samuel. We're in 2 Samuel chapter 11, the narrative that recounts David's disgraceful sin in the case of Bathsheba and Uriah, her husband. Then it happened in the spring, at the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all of Israel. They destroyed the sons of Ammon and besieged Rabbah, and David stayed at Jerusalem. Something ominous about that, we noted. And when evening came, David arose from his bed. He walked around on the roof of the king's house, and from the roof he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful in appearance. This narrative is black and white, cut and dried. It doesn't dwell on salacious details. So David sent and inquired about the woman, and they told her that it was Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite. All players in David's army and administration. David sent messengers. He took her. And when she came to him, it's cut and dried, he lay with her, and when she had purified herself from her uncleanness, she returned to her house. The woman conceived, and she sent and told David and said, "I am pregnant." David sent to Joab, and he said, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." So Joab sent Uriah to David. And now David, after his foul-up, begins his cover-up. After asking Uriah, as the narrative proceeds, about how things were progressing in the field, David got down to the real reason he brought Uriah home for a short furlough from battle. He urged this special forces soldier, this elite soldier, to just go home, kick back, give a little attention to his wife. He even sent Uriah away with a royal present, you know, perhaps some fine wines for the firelight to grease the romantic skid, so to speak. That way it would appear during that brief interlude that it was Uriah, not David, who impregnated Bathsheba. David, in his temporary insanity, thought all would be well and he would be home free. But David, of all people, in his temporary spiritual befogness, managed to forget about God, forget about accountability, forget that God was seeing all this unfold, that God was not going to let David succeed in covering it up. Either David was going to think about God and cut his losses, or he was going to try to game God with this stupid cover-up and go deeper and deeper into sin and dishonor God even more and his own legacy, and he was going to disturb the peace and harmony of his own royal house. Uriah, on his part, did not know what was up. Didn't matter. God knew everything. And in God's providence, this soldier, in his integrity, was not about to let his fellow soldiers suffer and shed blood in the field while he was lounging around at home and being intimate with his wife. No way. What a rebuke to David, who let his army go to battle, and unlike most kings in that day, he stayed home and let Joab lead the charge. Instead, Uriah just camped outside the palace door with the rest of the king's servants. The palace guard, we presume. He never saw the inside of his own bedroom while he was there, in this little bit of R&R. When David got word of that unexpected turn of events, he was frustrated. He was frustrated that his cover-up plan had been foiled by the military mettle of the man. Of all men, this should have prevented David from betraying his trust. It just shows his temporary madness. That's what sin will do. David tried to persuade him to chill out and to relax, not to be so militarily rigid. He deserved a little surcease from the rigors of war. Go home, Uriah, cheer up your wife, be happy in her loving arms. All of this was so unlike David. But when you see people get involved in deep sin, it can just warp their personality beyond recognition. We've seen it many times, sure you have too. But such a thought violated Uriah's high sense of military duty. Uriah said to David in verse 11, "The ark and Israel and Joab are staying in temporary quarters. My lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and drink and lie with my wife? By your life and the life of your soul, I will not do this thing and be disgraceful." But such a thought violated Uriah's high sense of military duty. With the sacred ark of God representing God's presence with the army of Israel, and with Joab and all the fellow soldiers of Israel braving the elements, sleeping in tents in the open field. In empathy, there was no way Uriah could afford himself the comforts of home under those conditions. I think every word of that must have pierced David's conscience to the bone. Uriah's loyalty to the ark of God, the symbol of God's presence among his people, and his fellow soldiers was much greater than had been David's to the God of the ark, and one of his fellow soldiers, Uriah. Again, it all shows, folks, where sin can take a person when it gains a little traction. As Jesus told his disciples, I remind you, be vigilant, be watchful, and pray, lest you enter into temptation, for the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. It took David to places that he would never have dreamed. David tried hard once again the very next evening to ply Uriah with royal food in abundance, in wine, in hope that Uriah would lose his self-control and head home to the bedroom. But again, it didn't work. Even drunker than a skunk, Uriah's sense of duty and loyalty to his leader and his troops was greater than that of a sober David to David's God and Uriah. How twisted is this? Sin can be like an 18-wheeler rolling downhill without brakes, a wreck waiting to happen. David's plans, now foiled by Uriah's loyalty to the Ark of God, is loyal to his leader Joab and his fellow soldiers. David's growing desperate. He can't have Uriah around to accuse him once this whole thing plays out. It threatened to be a scandal too big to manage. So in desperation, David, now having fouled up and foiled in his plan to cover up, he now takes the drastic set of a setup to take Uriah totally out of the picture. So after a couple of days, incredibly, David, of all people, all what sin allied with raw power can bring itself to do to others, unbeknownst to Uriah, he sends this great soldier back to the battlefield in Ammon with sealed orders that amount to his own death warrant. Sin is like a wild animal, folks. We let it loose. We don't put the brakes on it. There is no end to how savage it can be. Verse 14. It came about in the morning that David wrote a letter to Joab, and he sent it by the hand of Uriah. Boy, that was cruel. He had written in the letter, "Place Uriah in the front line of the fiercest battle. Withdraw from him, so that he may be struck down and die." How cold. And that's exactly what Joab did. David's orders were desperate and godless by any measure. The whole scene reminds me forcibly of what a professor of mine, Dr. S. Lewis Johnson, once told us, teaching 1 Corinthians in a Greek class. Dr. Johnson, looking up from his notes, I don't remember the passage, looked the whole class in the eye and he said, "Men, never underestimate your ability to fall into sin." Dear friends, unless we are vigilant in our spiritual disciplines and depend upon God's grace resources through the Holy Spirit, the flesh can really trip any of us up, and any of us can really make a mess of things. We can make a mess of our home, we can make a mess of the church, we can make a mess of the ministry and make a mess of our jobs, and worst of all, bring reproach upon the name of Christ and scandalize the gospel message. I've seen professing Christian people do that again and again and again, and it's startling. Joab, when he received this message, was just taking orders. He was no stranger to the exigencies and cruelties of war. He could not have known David's motive for this bizarre command. But hey, David was the king, not Joab, and David must have had his good reasons for this unusual directive. So, Joab did just as he was ordered, verse 16. He knew just the right spot to deploy the courageous Uriah and to leave him hopelessly stranded without backup, exposed. The exact military scenario is not described for us, but we know the dark side of the whole deal. Joab was a great military tactician, as was David. Joab knows the royal order dooms not only Uriah, an elite soldier, dooms him at the hands of the embattled Ammonites, a raid on the city wall, firing down, throwing rocks, shooting arrows. But apparently this stratagem ramifies in its callousness. For in verse 17, we see that it led to the death of other troops as well. They were just collateral damage in order to get Uriah killed. Some of the people among David's servants fell, we read, and Uriah the Hittite, not an Israelite natively, but a Hittite mercenary who adopted Israel and its God as his own, we take it. He also died. This is awful. Commanders in the field, when the king was not present in battle, were naturally expected to keep their king informed of the situation on the battlefield. On the heels of Uriah's death, as well as the other casualties that came when Joab obeyed David's order concerning Uriah, Joab dutifully sends to David a general field report, verse 18. Both Joab and David well knew the expert way to conduct a city siege. They both well knew the tactics that would have ordinarily been employed in such warfare by a commander like Joab would have been sufficiently prudent to avoid the casualties Joab is forced to report in verse 17. Such unnecessary loss of good men would stoke David's ire, Joab knew. The very idea of placing these people under the city wall where the battle was fiercest and where Joab's troops would be sitting ducks for the elite Ammonites, defending the city at that spot, probably near the city gate, well, it was just insane. In sending this casualty report by a military courier to the royal residence, Joab knew David would be frosted at the unnecessary loss of life. However, such exposure of some of his men, probably less than his best, but still his men, had been a cruel expedient to carry out the king's order to make sure that Uriah got killed in battle. Although, as I mentioned, Joab himself had no inside knowledge of the reason why this wicked setup was a matter of such urgency to his sovereign. So to cover his backside, Joab gave explicit instruction to his chosen courier, as he anticipated David's angry reaction to the reversal on the battlefield. Let me paraphrase. When you have given your report, Joab instructs, if the king should explode and demands to know why the heck we were so stupid as to push our attacking force up so near the city wall, where the defenders could pick us off like pigeons in a barrel, and if he goes on a big history lesson about the perils of such recklessness in a city siege, starts citing the folly of Ahimelech, the son of Jerubbaal, who died when a woman of all people flung a rock on his head and killed him at Thebes, and if he should wonder aloud why we should be so dumb as to repeat Abimelech's monumental tactical error, listen, don't try to explain or defend our actions. Just slip in right at the end of your report this quick footnote. And in addition, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. He'll want to know that. Of course, the courier had no knowledge of the significance of the death of Uriah to David. He only knew that Joab, for whatever reason, wanted him to finish his report on that note. His job was not to ask why. His job was simply to relay the information, and in the manner or order Joab directed. And he did as he was directed. Well, in verses 22 through 24, we have a record of the actual report the courier gave to David. It gives a little clearer picture of the way the battle in which Uriah died unfolded that day. As we read between the lines, apparently the Ammonites got brave. They decided to take the offensive rather than duck behind the walls and take fire, so to speak. So, as defenders on the wall gave them some covering fire from their errors, some of their better troops, I'm sure, debouched from the city gate, carried the battle into the field, hoping to surprise and disperse the Israelite forces. But their foray that day failed, as the army of Joab rocked them back on their heels, forced them back inside the city, we assume, at least those who survived, if any did. Meanwhile, archers staked out along the high city walls were firing arrows down into the ranks of the Israelite forces, driving them back. And in the process, that was making them easy targets for those archers upon top the walls. It was suicide. Joab could have prevented such a deadly tactical error, but in the interest of executing David's order concerning Uriah, Joab not only didn't restrain his brave pursuing soldiers, but in some way he must have orchestrated the folly so as to fatally expose the courageous Uriah to the enemy perched on the city wall. At the finish of the field report, given just as Joab had instructed, David callously, coldly, calmly, offers consolation to Joab after a bad day at the office, so to speak. To paraphrase verse 25, David responded, "Hey, just tell Joab you win some, you lose some," was about the tone of it. Those are the fortunes of war. The sword devours one as well as the other. So my instructions are just intensify your efforts, overthrow the city, and make him pay. So encourage Joab, sir, and tell him I'm behind him all the way. By his timely, covert, but cruel actions, David had covered his tracks, or so he imagined. With Uriah out of the picture, now no one could fault a merciful and grateful king for taking his pregnant widow, who would know now that she wasn't pregnant by Uriah, taking her now as his own wife. Wicked actions David has stage managed so that he had things set up so that he could come in out of this close call actually looking benevolent, loyal, and grateful. David was feeling greatly relieved at his close call with shame and disgrace, I imagine, and I would guess he was pretty pleased that he had managed to put a face on evil that made him look good. A lot of people who do evil, even in our churches, somehow deceive themselves to the point that as long as they can fool others by their pious face and their manipulation of reality, they honestly seem not to have any troubled conscience about the things they do in darkness. It is as if somehow, in their twisted thinking, if they have covered evil in the eyes of men, they also think they have covered it in the eyes of God. All that matters is public perception. I know of a pastor of a once very large church, a guy who had a popular radio ministry in his area, who turned out to be a moral wretch. Some knew that part of that picture was homosexual liaisons, though like David, he did a masterful job, somehow, of keeping the lid on the news, and to him, that was all that mattered. When one staff pastor, whom I knew very well, confronted him, reportedly, his answer was, "Hey, God has forgiven me, and that's all that matters." No, it is not, my friend. Such a man betrayed his calling, and such a man betrayed the trust of his people. Such a man disqualified himself, but no matter. Though his church, I understand, is greatly reduced, so far as I know, he is still at it, as if none of his nefarious behavior ever occurred. What a brazen face. What they, the people, don't know, or perhaps care about, doesn't matter. Lost on this fella is the fact that it matters a great deal to God. And since it has not been repented of, publicly confessed, no, God has not forgiven it. Well, David is about to find that out, and thankfully, come at last to his senses. We see that in chapter 12. In his temporary blindness to reality, David thought he had covered his tracks in the matter of his adultery with Bathsheba and his complicity in what amounted to the slaughter of Uriah. Well, wrong. How a man like David could forget about the all-seeing eyes of God, how David could forget about his accountability for such ramified evil, well, it's just hard to fathom. Could it be that David had been so favored by God for so long that the king had come to a point where he presumed upon God's favor? It happens. Could it be that he came to a point where God had so many times helped David, had so often come to his rescue in times of peril, had so elevated David to power and influence in the world. But David more or less came to see himself as the apple of God's eye. Could he have come to believe that he enjoyed such high standing in God's eyes that the same rules of the road that applied to others did not apply with the same rigor to him as to others? That's presumption. One of the well-known characteristics of so many people born into power and privilege is an aristocratic sense of entitlement. Had David's long years in power corrupted him a bit in that direction? Well, my guess is that it did, for it's hard on any other theory to find any more rational way to explain how such a godly man as David had been got from point A to point B. And therein is a lesson for all of us, but most especially for those of us who are Christian leaders. Over time, a notion may creep over us almost unconsciously that we are a sort of favored class, and we may get infected with the notion that God does not look at our sins with the same eyes as he looks at the sins of others. Something akin to that great error must have infected David's mind. Whatever it was, it brought him into terrible sin and very tragic and ramifying consequences, which are now about to unfold. No sooner than all this sin and intrigue had gone down, and David had wiped his royal brow in a great sense of relief, I imagine, then the Lord sent the prophet Nathan. The Lord was watching this all along, and he sent Nathan to confront David in a way that put this whole black affair in proper moral perspective. And he did so with a parable that blindsided David's defenses and caused him to condemn himself. The Lord sent Nathan to David, and Nathan came to him. You've got to admire this. Didn't matter that David was king. Nathan knew the real king, and he was not intimidated in the least by David's royal persona. Well, this was very clever, but it was inspired by the Spirit of God. There were two men in one city, one rich, the other poor, he said to David. The rich man had a great many flocks and herds. The poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb, which he bought and nourished, and it grew up together with him and his children. That little ewe lamb would eat of his bread and drink of his cup and lie in his bosom, and it was like a daughter to him. And now a traveler came to the rich man. There's lust and temptation. It's the devil. He was unwilling to take from his own flock or from his own herd to prepare for the wayfarer who had come to him. Rather, what he did, he took the poor man's ewe lamb, and he prepared it for the man who had come to him. Well, when Nathan told David that, David didn't recognize immediately that it was a parable. He thought it was a case. He had just heard a case of injustice, which he had, but he didn't know that it was a parabolic case. David's anger burned greatly against the man. He said to Nathan, "As the Lord lives, surely the man who has done this deserves to die, and he must make restitution for the lamb fourfold, because he did this thing and had no compassion." Nathan then said to David, "You are the man. Thus says the Lord God of Israel, it is I who anointed you king over Israel, and it is I who delivered you from the hand of Saul. And I gave you your master's house and all your master's wives into your care. I gave you the house of Israel and Judah. If that had been too little, I would have added to you many more things like these. So why have you despised the word of the Lord by doing evil in his sight?" We'll come back to that in the next study. This is Sobering. Thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you, and have a great day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.